the headlines. Ayatollah Khamenei says former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein imposed the 1980s war on Iran after getting the green light from the West. The Russian president announces a partial mobilization for the military campaign in Ukraine and accuses the West of engaging in nuclear blackmail against Moscow. And a new investigation uncovers further evidence that the death of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh at the hands of Israeli forces was deliberate.
Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says major world powers tried to topple the Islamic Republic by supporting former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remarks on the occasion of Iran's Sacred Defense Week. He said that world powers at the time could not tolerate a new independent country. That's why they decided to wage a war on Iran through a power-thirsty man who was at the helm in neighboring Iraq. He noted that Iranians, however, managed to upend the enemy's plots through their resistance. The leader said even though war is a bitter experience, Iranians were able to turn that threat into new opportunities by emboldening the domestic military and defense capabilities. Iraq waged an 8-year war against Iran only a year after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. During the war, Iraq was fully supported by the U.S. and its allies, while the same countries denied Iran access to foreign arms. Iran's president says that it will not be possible to reach an agreement on reviving the 2015 deal without closing Tehran's case. At the International Atomic Energy Agency, Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks in a meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron on the sidelines of the 77th UN General Assembly in New York. Raisi said the IAEA has officially acknowledged 15 times that Iran's activities are fully consistent with its commitments. He also told Macron that the European signatories need to prove that their policies are independent of the U.S. The Iranian president also discussed the nuclear issue in a separate meeting with Swiss President Ignacio Cassis. He said it's reasonable for Tehran to demand guarantees for a durable deal given the history of Washington's behavior and how it left the deal. Back in 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the multilateral agreement on Iran's nuclear program and reimposed illegal sanctions on Tehran.
The 77th United Nations General Assembly has opened, with the UN Secretary General warning of a winter of discontent as many Western nations are economically reeling from the backfiring of their sanctions on Russia. Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi will give his first address to the UN on September 21st, with a focus on creating a more just world through economic multilateralism. Raisi met with French President Emmanuel Macron and top leaders of the European Union, but amid what Iranian delegates described as a very tense atmosphere. France and the other Western signatories have failed, for years, to adhere to the 2015 Landmark Agreement, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Raisi told Macron that Europe needs to show that its foreign policies are guided by the sovereign interests of their citizens and actually separate from the demands of Washington. This week, Raisi will hold bilateral meetings with the heads of Iraq, Pakistan, Japan, and more than a half dozen other nations, as well as with representatives of a large Iranian-American community, a group estimated to be well over 2 million people. Raisi stressed that Iran is willing to reach a, quote, fair and stable agreement to revive the 2015 deal, but that Iran needs to receive reassuring guarantees that the U.S. will not withdraw from the accord, as it did in May 2018. Ramin Mazahiri, New York City.
President Vladimir Putin is warning the West that Russia would use all available means to respond to threats against its territorial integrity. Putin is accusing Western countries of engaging in nuclear blackmail and trying to destroy Russia. He says Moscow has enough weapons to respond, insisting that this is not just a bluff. Speaking during a televised speech, Putin also ordered Russia's first mobilization since World War II. That announcement drew an immediate reaction from Ukraine, which said the decision shows the conflict is not going according to Moscow's plan. The UK has also reacted with its foreign minister saying Putin's threats must be taken seriously. The Russian president also said The purpose of the military operation in Ukraine is to liberate the Donbas region. He said most people in the region don't want to return to what he called the yoke of Ukraine. Greg Simons is a researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies. He believes the West has been fanning the flames of the Russia-Ukraine war with its continued arms supplies to Ukraine.
For Russia, Ukraine is a strategic security issue, and that they are resolute on resolving what they see as a security threat developed there, which has been aided by the United States and the West in general. So, I mean, this is a clear indication. It's also the West has been escalating it with different weapons and pledges and so forth, which has not stopped. And this is one step up to demonstrate Russia's resolute will to see it through.
Thousands of bus drivers in the United Kingdom are planning to go on strike over low wages amid the country's deepening cost of living crisis. Over 2,600 bus operators in London and Kent County are planning to walk off their job later this month and early October. They are demanding higher salaries to manage living expenses. Union organizer Unite says drivers will stay on strike until the dispute is resolved. A worsening cost of living crisis in Britain has sparked industrial actions in many sectors, including railways, airlines, and ports, over pay and work conditions. Unionists say the wave of soaring industrial unrest is caused by decades high inflation, which has eroded earnings and reduced purchasing power. Well, Italy's elections are 5 days away. Opinion polls show the leader of far-right Brothers of Italy party is a leading candidate to replace outgoing Prime Minister Mario Draghi. Max Chiuli reports from Rome.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history.
There is a strong disaffection with politics in Italy, but while in the elections held 5 years ago, the five-star movement was able to intercept people's anger and dissatisfaction. This time, there doesn't seem to be a party strong enough to do the same.
According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018.
I don't have faith in establishment politics, but I don't know who to vote for. At the same time, I think not voting could be even worse. I'm really undecided.
The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?
A few days ago, the US government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the US move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the US certainly did the same.
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
New evidence shows that Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh was intentionally targeted and killed by an Israeli soldier despite the regime's claim that it was an accident. A London-based research group and a Palestinian rights group have conducted a fresh investigation into the controversial case. They say the sniper's precise angle of fire shows the Israeli soldier was clearly able to tell that there were journalists around. The sniper first shot twice to kill Abu Akleh and then proceeded to open fire on those who tried to rescue her. The Palestinian journalist was killed 4 months ago while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Israel has acknowledged that Israeli fire probably killed Abu Akleh, but denies allegations that a soldier intentionally targeted her. Abu Akleh's family has submitted an official complaint to the International Criminal Court demanding justice for her killing. Award-winning Palestinian journalist and activist Laith Maruf comes out to decry a smear campaign launched against him for slamming Zionism and crimes committed by the Israeli regime. Maruf has stressed that the right to offend Israeli oppressors is the essence of freedom of thought, belief, opinion, and expression. He made the remarks at a panel of experts titled "The Right to Offend Colonizers and Collaborators." The panel discussion took place as an interparliamentary task force made up of pro-Zionist Western politicians grilled social media companies over Maruf's posts. The task force has discussed measures that would censor critiques of human rights abuses carried out by the Tel Aviv regime. Maruf was banned from Twitter over false accusations of racism and hate speech leveled by the Zionist lobby and repeated by Canadian politicians. Canada has also defunded the organization that Maruf works for. U.S. forces illegally stationed in Syria continue to plunder its natural resources, shipping more oil out of the country. Syrian media reports suggest that the American troops looted 60 oil tankers and smuggled them out of the Hasakah province into U.S. bases in neighboring Iraq. Earlier this week, the U.S. troops sent a convoy of over 80 trucks, including tens of tankers carrying stolen Syrian oil to Iraq via the illegal border crossings of al-Mahmoudiyah and al-Walid. American forces are deployed in Syria without any authorization from Damascus or a UN mandate. Former President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in the country for its oil wealth. Damascus says the U.S. and its allied militants have pillaged over 80% of Syria's daily crude production in the first half of 2022. The ceremony has been held in the Syrian capital to honor journalists who lost their lives during the years-long war in the Arab country. Muhammad Ali reports from Damascus.
Syria's Ministry of Information organized an event to pay tribute to journalists who were killed while covering the war on the country. Syrian officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, technicians, and other workers in the media sector.
The martyrs of media are the true heroes on battlefields alongside the Syrian Arab army. They will remain alive in our memory. Meeting their families is a great honor because they represent truly an example of strength and loyalty to the homeland. We are honoring them today to thank them for their great sacrifices.
Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation expressing how proud they are that their family members' blood was one of the main reasons for Syria's victory over terrorism.
This event means a lot to me. When I receive a call on an honoring, I feel that my son is still remembered and even still around. This land requires us to sacrifice. Without sacrifice, we would have no future.
My son was a war correspondent. He was martyred near Kanetra. He was my only son. He sacrificed his blood for the country. The enemy and its media outlets were strong and working to weaken Syria. But thanks to the sacrifices of Syrians, we triumphed.
Press TV's correspondent Maya Nasser was also among the list of journalists who lost their lives during the Syrian conflict. He was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He is one of many journalists who was keen on always being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. Despite knowing the dangers of reporting on battlefields, many journalists risked their lives to report on the truth of events. Tens were killed or injured, defending the principles of journalism and showing responsibility in conveying what was truly happening on the ground in the face of a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Less than 2 weeks to Brazil's presidential elections, former President Lula da Silva is widening his lead against incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. According to an opinion poll, the leftist former president now has a 10% lead over Bolsonaro. That indicates a 2-point increase from last week. Lula is backed by 44% of the voters, while Bolsonaro maintains a 34% support. The survey expects a runoff in which Lula would win 50% of the ballots. President Bolsonaro has seen his popularity drop due to his controversial management of the coronavirus pandemic and the economy. He's planning to retire from politics if he fails to win the upcoming vote.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil, holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy. Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante, Curitiba.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
King Charles has ascended to the British throne at a time when people in the countries that were once exploited by the British wish the monarchy fade away soon. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned, please.
We'll be right back.
Asia Times wrote, "The death of Queen Elizabeth, the longest-serving monarch of British royalty, has sparked global fascination and spawned thousands of clickbait reports of the details of her funeral. Americans who centuries ago rejected monarchy are seemingly obsessed with the ritualism, bizarrely mourning the demise of an elderly and fabulously wealthy woman who was born into privilege and who died of natural causes at the ripe old age of 96 across the ocean. Perhaps this is because popular and long-running TV shows about British royalty like The Crown have convinced that we know intimate details about the royals, and worse, they cause us to believe we should care about a family that is a symbolic marker of past imperial grandeur. But for those who are descended from the subjects of British imperialist conquest, the Queen, her ancestors, and her descendants represent the ultimate evil empire." One could argue that Elizabeth, who was gifted the throne and its title in 1952, did not lead an aggressive empire of conquest and instead presided over an institution that, under her rule, became largely symbolic and ceremonial in nature. And indeed, many do just that. Raoul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade, has a different opinion, referring in an interview to Elizabeth as a morally unremarkable person with a job that involved doing extremely unremarkable things. Mahajan explains further, saying that this was a highly privileged person given an opportunity to influence world events in some degree, which she had to do nothing to earn, who never did anything particularly remarkable, innovative, or insightful. While Elizabeth's 7 years on the throne were mostly spent overseeing an ostensible unraveling of British Empire in a world less intolerant of occupation, enslavement, and imperial plunder, just a few months into her role as queen, the British violently put down the Mau Mau rebellion in Kenya. According to New York Times, a story about how citizens in African nations today have little sympathy for the dead monarch, the squashing of the rebellion led to the establishment of a vast system of detention camps and torture, rape, castration, and killing of thousands of people. Even if Elizabeth was not responsible for directing the horrors, they were carried out in her name. Over the 7 decades that she wielded symbolic power, she never once apologized for what was done during her rule in Kenya, or indeed what was done in her family's name in dozens of other nations in the global south. It's no wonder that black and brown people the world over have openly expressed disgust at the collective fawning of such an ugly legacy. Professor Uju Anya of Carnegie Mellon University, who is Nigerian, is under fire for her frank dismissal of Elizabeth after posting on Twitter that she heard the chief monarch of a thieving and raping genocidal empire is finally dying. May her pain be excruciating. Kehinde Andrews, a black studies professor at Birmingham City University, wrote on Politico that he cannot relate to his fellow Britons' desire to mourn Elizabeth, a woman he considered to be the number one symbol of white supremacy and a manifestation of the institutional racism that we have to encounter on a daily basis. According to the New York Times, as Prince Charles used tax breaks, offshore accounts, and canny real estate investments to turn a sleepy state into a billion-dollar business. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists in 2017 found that both Elizabeth and Charles were named in the leaked Paradise Papers, indicating that they hid their money in havens to avoid paying taxes. Fleecing taxpayers and living off stolen wealth, monarchy's original modus operandi appears to be central to Elizabeth's legacy, one she passes on to her son, who also won't pay an inheritance tax on the wealth she left him. The British monarchy, according to Mahajan, mostly represents a real concession to the idea that some people are just born better and more important than you, and you should look to them. It's a good time for the popularity of this institution to fade away soon.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. Alhamdulillah, we are able to focus on the 30th sermon of Nahjul Balagha, where Imam Ali alayhi salam discusses about an important event that took place just at the onset of his caliphate, and that was the uprising of the people under the banner of a vengeance towards those who killed Uthman, rather avenging the death of Uthman, and the blame was placed solely on Imam Ali alayhi salam, which, as we said historically, is an unfair, judgment and an unfair statement to kind of say that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the perpetrator for this whole thing. And if you see in history, I mean, it's clear Imam Ali alayhi salam himself says that I did not order it. And all those discussions that we had previously, though Imam Ali alayhi salam clearly says that there were some huge errors that were happening at the time of Uthman that needed correcting. And since that correction was not happening, a large number of the ashab of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, the muhajirin and the ansar, were silent when people, uprised against Uthman, and even they aimed to murder him. And of course, what happened, and we discussed about the fact that these historical events are some things that Imam Ali alayhi salam is giving for the people to see and kind of observe the way he's analyzing and the way he's concluding issues so that people can learn the right way and in the right way how to interpret history.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are discussing about a very important discussion, and that is that Imam Ali alayhi salam, after the what happened, when Uthman was murdered by a group of people, and the reaction of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and how people tried to put the blame on him, and what response he gave at that time. All of this is kind of a history lesson, a kind of a political, sociological lesson that we need to learn from. Imam Ali alayhi salam at the end says, وَأَنَا جَامِعٌ لَكُمْ أَمْرًا. Of course, after all this has happened, I am the one who is going to conclusively come and, you know, show you the way. I'm going to explain to you what's the reality of the issue and what we need to do. I'm going to conclude this whole event for you all. And that is the skill of a leader, to be able to interpret history, to interpret events in a way that, you know, they can be understood properly and they can be concluded in the right way. Now here comes a discussion here, is that why do we need to interpret history in the onset? But why? You see, there are certain things that happen between human beings in the sociological arena, in the societal arena, and these things that happen follow general principles we call divine principles in the society. They are followed. These are divine principles in history that, you know, that recur, that kind of happen, and therefore, you know, sometimes you say history repeats itself. Yeah, it's actually, in a one way, it's a true statement, because there are certain principles that govern these things. But how do you understand these principles is when you treat this event in history like an experiment, like a scientific experiment, and see what are those elements and what are those factors that affect a certain thing to happen. Just like, you know, you keep, you know, hydrogen and oxygen together in a certain chamber, and then you spark, you place a spark and you see what kind of reaction happens. Maybe water forms or some other elements are formed. All of these is something that we need to observe. When a certain element is added or a certain factor is changed, there is a change, a transformation that occurs.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, we need to analyze history in probably the same way, to see what are the factors that lead to a certain change in the society. We notice that suddenly a society begins to grow, it begins to progress. In history, we see that how did this progress happen? How did it happen? How did this progress occur? When we treat it like and observe it that way, we see that there were certain factors that led to that kind of, progress. What were those factors? Maybe it was when people were more planned, when they had more organization, when people were more honest, when people were more, you can say, observant of each other's rights, when they were kind to one another, we see that there was a change. Or, for example, if people were oppressive to one another, they would kill, they would do harm, they would lie, those societies would for example, dwindle and get destroyed with time. This is something that you need to observe in history and see that. And you need a very powerful personality to come and look at history in that way and learn and teach you that. You need to observe that interpreter. Come and interpret and untwine those intertwined factors that led to a certain thing. So you need that person. You know, like in the normal experiments that we have, when you see your teacher doing that experiment, see the dexterity, that intelligence that he shows in his work, the accuracy and the steps that he follows practically, that observance is important. And this is how the people, they need to raise their awareness by looking at their leader. And Imam Ali alayhi salam was doing exactly that. He was showing them how to interpret history, how to look for those factors, how to dissect them, how to separate them. And this is something that is very important. Inshallah, we'll in the next session explain why this is all the more important in today's age and also in every age to understand events in the society. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. China plans to warmly invite Taiwan back into its arms. The Chinese acted with soft power by increasing trade and tourism between the two countries. A soft power approach amounts to persuading the Taiwanese people that there is no reason to fear reunification with the motherland. We now present you an article written by Mohammad Reza Jofar, an expert in geopolitics. The piece is titled Soft Power, China's Strategy for Taiwan. The geostrategic atmosphere in the South China Sea has been tense following the recent visit to Taiwan by U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. This brought to the fore the issue of China's marine embargo and Beijing's need to access strategic straits in East Asia, which have been traditionally controlled by allies of the U.S., including Japan, the Philippines and Indonesia. China's eastern and northeastern ports are limited to marine routes that go through the Sea of Japan and the East China Sea. On the south and southeast, Chinese ships have to cross the Malacca and Sunda Straits in the Philippines and Indonesia to access international waters. Therefore, Beijing attaches great importance to facilitating the transit of its ships and the possible escalation of tension between China and these countries over marine routes has been a subject of discussion by experts in geopolitics over the past two decades. There is an archipelago between China and the Pacific Ocean, which Beijing calls the first island chain that falls within the limits of its territory. China's relations with its neighbors have been damaged over the ownership of more than 200 small coral islands. These sea passages provide access to some of the world's most important shipping routes through the South China Sea. China is trying to gain control of all these passages because it fears that at a time of heightened tensions, it may lose access to them. Japan has been a major impediment to China's free access to the Pacific Ocean. Look at the existing sea routes shows that when Chinese ships leave the Yellow Sea and circle the Korean Peninsula, they have to cross the Sea of Japan and La Perouse Strait before gaining access to the Pacific Ocean. Most of this area falls within the marine territories of Japan or Russia and may be close to China in times of heightened tension. Even if the Chinese cross the strait, they must still go through the Kuril Islands to the northeast of Hokkaido, which are collectively controlled by Russia but claimed by Japan. Although China and Japan have many border disputes, the row over La Perouse Strait is the most important one, which restricts China's shipping in the northern and eastern waters of the country. Taiwan, whose official name is the Republic of China, is also known as the Chinese Taipei, National China, and Formosa. It is a region in East Asia comprised of the islands of Taiwan, Penghu, Kinmen, Matsu, and a number of other small islands. All of them are located off China's eastern coast. By its sea borders, this island nation neighbors the People's Republic of China on the west, Japan on the northeast, and the Philippines on the south. Taiwan is located below Okinawa in the South China Sea and is away from mainland China. Chinese officials consider it as their country's 23rd province. However, it is currently an ally of the United States and its naval and air forces are equipped with American weaponry. Taiwan went under China's ownership in the 17th century. According to the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979, the United States is committed to defending Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. However, this will not be the case if Taiwan declares its separation from the mainland, as a secessionist policy by Taiwan is considered a major provocation and will be deemed an act of war by China. Both governments strive to gain official recognition for themselves, and it is Beijing that has been mostly successful in this regard. With a population of 1.4 billion against Taiwan's 23 million, China enjoys more power of persuasion and geopolitical clout than Taiwan. The Chinese do not want Taiwan to be able to vie militarily with Beijing. Instead, they have acted with soft power by increasing trade and tourism between the two countries. China plans to warmly invite Taiwan back into its arms, a soft war approach amounts to persuading the Taiwanese people that there is no reason to fear reunification with the motherland. China's general policy is to try to maintain good relations with most of its bordering countries, so as not to allow any separation movement to be organized or supported. What is certain is that China will never let go of Taiwan due to geopolitical reasons, because Taiwan is both a commercial and an energy transit route and a buffer zone for China against the Pacific Ocean. Also, it is not unlikely that China's failure to govern Taiwan will trigger widespread internal unrest that will threaten the Communist Party's influence and China's unity, because if the Chinese government accepts Taiwan's separation from the mainland, it is possible that the suburban and marginal areas would enter into a conflict with the central government in Beijing. This, in turn, would also bring the buffer zones into the conflict. Nevertheless, in a situation where China's military power is on the rise, Taiwan and the United States will show less desire for a military conflict. For Beijing, Taiwan is a small threat that can be managed. Now that China is the second largest economy in the world, it has a global advantage. Beijing has the initiative, and in the event of any sanctions or war, the United States will suffer more than any other country. While the European Union was the main victim of the sanctions regime against Russia, the situation is completely different in the case of China. Moreover, the international community will not be able to take the brunt of sanctions against China. China views Taiwan through a geopolitical security lens, and they would naturally assume that the Westerners are trying to harm China's security. However, China's security will not be compromised. Political geography and realities on the ground are against Taiwan's secessionist policy. It should be noted that China will not show much flexibility in the case of a blockade of the existing sea routes, such as the Sunda Strait, the Taiwan Strait, and the Malacca Strait, through which 80% of China's energy resources pass. In case such policies are implemented, an all-out crisis will occur in the South China Sea. Beijing intends to dissuade its neighbors from getting close to the United States and change the opinion and method of the United States as well. Therefore, it is investing in deep water ports in these regions, an investment that would bring China closer relations, trade connections, and the possibility of friendly bases in other countries for naval deployment. China considers Taiwan as a breakaway province that should be reunited with the mainland, under the internationally recognized One China policy. Under that policy, nearly all countries recognize Beijing's sovereignty over the island, including the United States of America, which has no formal diplomatic ties with the territory. However, in violation of its own stated policy and in an attempt to irritate Beijing, Washington continues to court the secessionist government in Taipei. Supporting its anti-China stance, and supplying it with massive caches of armaments. In flaming tensions between the United States and China, the 82-year-old Nancy Pelosi stepped in Taiwan on 2nd of August, prompting Beijing to react to the highest-level U.S. visit to Taiwan in 25 years, with a burst of military activity in the island's surrounding waters. Recently, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said at a press conference in Beijing that China would resolutely fight back against every U.S. provocative act that undermines its sovereignty and territorial integrity and meddles with its domestic affairs. Warning of the escalation in tensions, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said, "Pelosi's trip to Taiwan is a major political provocation to upgrade U.S.-Taiwan exchanges. The United States conducts up to 100 military exercises in China's surrounding waters every year, but accuses China of overreacting. China will not accept this thuggish logic, nor will the international community." The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman, Wang Wenbin, also noted that every time the American side makes a serious provocative act of infringing on China's sovereignty and interfering in China's internal affairs, the Chinese side will resolutely fight back. China will never allow its sovereignty and territorial integrity to be wantonly trampled upon and sabotaged.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith which has been narrated from Imam Ali alayhi salam. This hadith is about things which expiate and cancel sins out, erase the effects of the sin in this world. There's various things which can expiate and cancel sins out. For example, let's count some of them. Some of them are punishment in this world. God Almighty may punish a person for his sins in this world. This cancels the sins out. Illnesses, these cancel out sins. They wipe them away. The person won't be punished for them in the hereafter. Sorrows, sadness, this cancels sins out. Good deeds, you know, hasanat. Innal hasanate yudhibna sayyat, a famous verse of the Holy Quran, that good deeds, they wipe away the sins. Good character, Good character wipes away the sins. Bringing solace to a grief-sicken person, this also wipes away the sins. There's other things as well, which these things have been mentioned in the books of ethics and Quranic commentary. Right now, we want to concentrate on the first one we mentioned, which is punishment in this world. Imam Ali alayhi salam has been narrated to have said, "No servant from amongst our followers," meaning our Shia, "who commits an act that we have forbidden dies without first being afflicted with a severe calamity which expiates his sins, be it with regard to his wealth, his children, or his own soul, such that he meets Allah with a clean slate." Right? So if there's a person who is a follower of the Ahlul Bayt, the Shia, and he has, all of us have, you know, more or less sinned in this world, major sins, minor sins, you know, none of us can claim to be, you know, perfect. All of us have made mistakes. God Almighty, because he loves those who love his prophet and his family, he wishes such people to enter his presence with a clean slate so they won't be punished in the hereafter. So God afflicts them with trials and tribulations in this world. And if they're patient, God Almighty wipes away their sins because of it, and so that they meet Allah with a clean slate. In continuation, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Moreover, if any of his sins remain even after that," what happens if, you know, even after this punishment, some of his sins remain? "What will happen?" the Imam says, "Then they are expiated by the pain and difficulty at the time of death." You know, the pangs of death, the pain that the soul undergoes and is afflicted with at the time of death, you know, which is one of those very difficult times. This is another thing that wipes away the sins of a person. One of the Shia, if some of his sins should remain even after the calamities that befall him before that time. This is one of the things, one of the ways in which the sins are wiped away. As you can see, this is specifically allocated for the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, according to this hadith. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at calamities and tribulations of this world as ways in which sins are expiated in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Major development has taken place when it comes to the Donbass republics. They will conduct a referendum to join Russia. Even dates have been announced. The referendums to join Russia will be held in the Luhansk or Donetsk People's Republic, LPR and DPR, from September 23 to the 27th. The West calls this a travesty, happening in the middle of a war. What about the people? Shouldn't they be counted? Doesn't their vote count? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look what would happen if these regions join Russia and how Ukraine will react, who has vowed to take back every inch of its territory, even if the referendum decides these regions are part of Russia. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist, activist, and political analyst John Busnich joins us from Belgrade.